I mean, fundamentally, I get, you know, asked this probably just as much as you guys do. Right. And I can say that I really don't like this question.
Okay.
I know when I first started, like, the first watch that I loved was, like, a 1016 Explorer, okay? And I loved it because of the way it looked, the story, the history. You know, I just find it a little odd when people are like, hey, you know, what should I get into first? Again, I think you should be buying something that you like.
That's what we always say on the Greynado when somebody writes in with what should I buy? It's just buy something that's in your price point that you like, that makes you happy.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week we've got our first ever repeat guest. Collector and dealer Eric Koo was our guest on episode 5, and with the fall auctions approaching, we figured it was about time we bring him back and chat a little bit about the state of vintage watch collecting. But to start things off, Ben, Cole, and I sat down for a conversation about the Only Watch auction just a few hours after we attended the preview here in New York. We cover what Only Watch is, why it's interesting, and some of our favorite watches that'll hit the block in November. All right, let's get to it. Hey, gentlemen. We've been spending a lot of time together today.
Yeah, not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing at all.
We're sure it's not a bad thing, Cole?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to be polite.
We started the day off together. It's kind of the end of the day here in New York, and we started the day off together at Christie's Uptown to check out the Only Watch highlights.
Yeah, we did.
It's a big day of the year, every other year, I guess, for Only Watch. And Cole, this was your first Only Watch preview, right?
This is, yeah. It's the first time I've even learned about what Only Watch is and so forth. So it was the first preview and first the introduction to Only Watch.
Nice. Yeah, for people who may not know, so Only Watch is a charity auction. It's held every other year. It goes back to like 2005. Christie's had it for a while. Then it went to Phillips. Now it's back at Christie's. And the idea is basically that brands create unique one-off pieces. They're sold for charity, for a muscular dystrophy charity. And it kind of drives the collector community a little bit crazy for a little while every fall.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are mixed feelings about Only Watch. I mean, the idea of all these great brands doing piece uniques is pretty compelling, for sure. You often see that there are very few brands actually making anything new for Only Watch. It's like a new dial, a new case, whatever. F.P. Jorn being the notable exception. He really does make like a new movement for Only Watch, which is pretty neat. And you know, again, I kind of have mixed feelings, like many collectors about it. You have this idea that like these things are going to be worth a lot of money, and in some cases they are. In some cases, you see like the marketing gal versus the PR person versus the CEO bidding against each other to make sure their watch sells for retail. That has happened.
Of course, I've seen it.
And you know, in many ways, it's, you know, a lot of the great brands like a Vacheron, a Lange, I guess we do have AP this time, don't participate because you're always going to be second fiddle to Patek. The Patek is the number one watch by a wide margin every single time without fail since the inception of this idea.
Yeah.
So you don't get the Langes, you don't get the Vacherons, you don't get these really special brands participating because who wants to for sure be number two? You know what I mean? On a good day.
It's true.
And so it's really weird because, I mean, if you look at the values of the past few auctions, like the Patek usually accounts for more than 50% of the sales prices of any of these sales.
Right. And there's like 50 watches per
sale.
Correct.
Right. Yes. So it's this weird kind of like imbalanced thing where it really just becomes the Patek Philippe show at times. Sometimes Tudor, sometimes F.P. Jorn. There are some exceptions. We expect the Ecrivier to do well this time.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, I mean, it's the Patek Philippe show. And I think, you know, it's some people don't like it because of that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so you've mentioned three brands already, right? That kind of are three, I would say, like pillars of Only Watch, right? You have Patek always ends up being the highest selling piece. You have F.P. Jorn, who's really the only watchmaker that does a genuinely new movement for Only Watch. And then you have Tudor, who has watches that typically sell for a few thousand dollars, selling watches for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So let's kind of walk through each of those. So let's start with Patek maybe, right? So this year, Patek is doing a steel version of the Grandmaster Chime, which is their most complicated wristwatch.
Yep.
Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's an ugly watch. It's just a watch that, like, is it going to be the most expensive watch? Like, no question. I bet literally every dollar I have on it. But does it really mean anything? Maybe, maybe not. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, we were chatting earlier, or I guess by now, a story that I've written will be out. And it's like, it's not a classical Patek. The 5208, which they did in titanium last time, is more classical than this. The time before that, they did a steel 5016, which was steel, blue enamel, min-repeating tourbillon. Like, that is, like, the most Patek. Even before that, they did a titanium 5004. Like, those are Patek references that get everybody excited, even if you don't even know what Patek is, you know?
Yeah.
The Grandmaster Chime is just such a behemoth in every way that, like, I just... It's not exciting to me. It's really not. This watch could become a mega valuable watch. This could be an eight-figure watch for sure. But I just don't care.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to imagine anybody wearing this one. Whereas, like, I'm looking at a picture of the 5016 right now, and, like, I would kill to wear that watch. That watch is incredible looking. Yeah,
5016, Hiroshi Fujiwara now has Eric Clapton's. Like, Eric Clapton was buying them. You know, John Mayer has them. Like, guys that are deep, deep into this world really have loved the 5016, certainly the 5004, which came before.
Right.
5208 is a pretty cool watch, different thing. But, yeah. I mean, I would still wear that watch. The Grandmaster Chime is just like, it's just so far out there. I just don't know who this is appealing to.
Yeah.
I tried it on. This is one of the few Pateks I've ever actually had on my wrist.
What do you think?
I want to give Patek another chance. I think this is a bad way to enter. Yeah.
The most expensive Patek is a bad way to enter.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. It's kind of, it's unsightly. It's weird on the wrist. It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you said, it's not, you should give it a second chance for sure.
There are wonderful Pateks.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean,
this is, I hate to say this is not one of them, but I mean, this is certainly not an iconic Patek Philippe, even though it is the big boy in the room, you know?
So when the 5016 sold, it became the most expensive wristwatch ever sold at that time.
I believe that is true. Yeah.
Yeah,
so that took over for the steel 1450, I'm sorry, the platinum world timer from Antiquorum in like 2005, 2006.
Yep.
This was pre-steel 1518. This was pre-Paul Newman, obviously.
Yeah, this was in 2015.
Right.
And it was 7.3 million Swiss.
Monster number.
Oof.
Huge number.
There seem to be rumors circulating that maybe the Grandmaster Chime becomes the most expensive wristwatch ever made, that it maybe unseats the Paul Newman.
Yeah. Yeah,
you think that's likely?
I mentioned it in the story that I wrote for the site recently. I think it's possible. I really do. I mean, I think the idea of the most complicated Patek in steel with a salmon dial, you know, is just hitting on every nerve in the collecting community right now. It would be a shame, in my opinion. Not that it's not a wonderful technical achievement, that watch, but the Paul Newman, first of all, it's Paul Newman, cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, really cool guy.
Super cool.
Like the coolest.
The coolest guy. Yeah.
Maybe the coolest guy. After Gray Cormier.
Yeah.
but I mean, that, as I said to you guys earlier, like that watch created an entire vertical of collecting. And basically the entire world of collectible vintage sports watches can be drawn back to that watch, like to the Paul Newman. That's a massively important watch. Granted, technically, whatever, it's a Valjoux 72, but like it created this community that we're a part of and that we love so much. The Grandmaster Chime doesn't touch anybody. It touches the six guys that bought that watch in 2000, whenever, when they did the 175th anniversary.
Yeah.
The cool part is that it went beyond our little world as well, you know?
Like, yeah,
yes,
right.
They created this vertical of collecting, but even non-watch people can appreciate the Paul Newman Daytona.
And,
I don't know about this one, you know?
And when the Paul Newman sold, it was like mainstream news. When the Grandmaster Chime sells for however many millions, like, nobody outside our world is going to care.
Unless it becomes the most expensive watch, right?
Yeah,
And then I think it will. And I think also, like, you know, the way that I look at collecting and things like this, and it's like, what is really good for us? And by us, I don't mean Hodinkee or Ben. I mean, like, for watch people in the watch industry. The Paul Newman was great because it's a Daytona that you, in theory, can go into a store and buy for $10,000, $12,000, whatever. It's really easy to understand. It's digestible. It has this, you know, super handsome, amazing philanthropic guy tied with it. And it makes people feel good. I'm like, oh, like, I could see myself getting into collectible watches. You see the Grandmaster Chime, and I feel like it's going to turn people off. If that becomes the biggest watch in the world, most expensive wristwatch in the world, people are going to look at it and be like, okay, first of all, it's ugly. Second of all, there are only six other ones, at least in its original iteration, and they're $3 million each, and they don't exist on the open market at all. And it's just not a world that I think people find very attractive in today's day and age. I think if this were 2008, it would be a different story. But right now, I just don't see people being drawn into that like hyper-complicated, hyper-opulent kind of world of watchmaking.
Yeah, agreed. So we got to let you go. Yeah. You got to go do like real CEO things instead of recording podcasts.
Actually, this
with
is a
us.
Real CEO moment.
Yeah, is it? All right, so we had to let Ben go. He had to go do, like, I guess, actual CEO things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take phone calls,
someone's
make deals.
Someone's got to do it, you know.
Yeah, keep us employed. Yeah. But we'll finish this thing off. You know, we mentioned earlier that Tudor is another company that kind of on the opposite end of Patek has its own, like, crazy OnlyWatch story, which is in 2015, the same year that the 5016 sold. The next kind of most impressive watch was the Tudor Black Bay 1, which was a Black Bay inspired by the very earliest Tudor sub. It kind of had that, like, you know, big hash bezel, the pencil hands, lollipop seconds hand, sort of almost like a Black Bay 58 before the Black Bay 58.
Right. It's a precursor.
And it sold for over 100 times the retail price of a standard Black Bay, which is absolutely crazy. At the time, a Black Bay was $3,100 US. And this thing sold for 375,000 Swiss francs. It's actually over 120 times list price.
Wow. People
went nuts. I mean, I remember when this auction happened, and like, I didn't really believe it when I first saw the results. I was like, did somebody tweet something wrong? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And then you started talking to people and it made a lot more sense. Like,
do you think it's because, you know, people are, it's an auction for charity and so forth, and one thing leads to another, and people are just more friendly with their wallets.
I think so.
Or is it something about the watch itself?
I think it's something about the watch. I think, I mean, not to, you know, say that Tudor isn't strong on its own, but like, Tudor is a part of Rolex. It's a part of the Rolex family.
Yeah.
Any piece unique coming out of Rolex or Tudor, these are just not brands that really do limited editions. Like, even limited editions of a couple hundred or a couple thousand pieces would be a huge deal from either brand. The chance to own a unique Tudor is a crazy thing. And the fact that this one, I mean, they've done a couple watches since for OnlyWatch that have done plenty well. They're nice looking watches. This is basically Tudor made the watch that
everybody
would want, and they made one of them.
Right. Like, it's a tease. That's a tease.
Yeah. And like, yeah. I give it to them, like, from a marketing standpoint, like, this is brilliant, you know? I am sure they sold a lot of Black Bays because of this.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that was part of the plan, you know? It was kind of a ramp up for the 58.
Yeah, exactly. So that was cool. And then the last brand that before we get into your kind of highlights from the experience this morning, is FP Journe. So Ben mentioned that most people, it's a new dial color, it's a different bezel, it's maybe something on a bracelet. Like, it's always a, like, minor change. Journe builds new movements, which is kind of like the most FP Journe thing imaginable.
A little extra.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they ask him, like, hey, will you do something special for us? And he's like, sure, and then spends 4 years developing a new caliber to, like, really blow everyone away. And so the one that kind of, I think, most people probably know about already was, for OnlyWatch 2017, because remember, this is every other year. So the last OnlyWatch was in 2017. He created a mono pusher split seconds chronograph, kind of an homage to the Rolex 4113.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's oversized, super thin, kind of a dramatic dial. It had the blue dial from, like, the chronometer blue, but with, like, red and yellow accents. It's a pretty crazy looking watch. But it was also a brand new manually wound mono pusher chronograph caliber. And at the time, nobody knew whether that caliber was going to make its way into a mainline watch. Turns out it did, the mono poussoir Rattrapant, in a slightly modified version with the date. It's not exactly the same movement, but it was a big deal. I mean, the fact that, like, Journe, again, we talk about, like, giving people what they want, like, Journe comes out with a mono pusher hand wound split second chronograph. Like, that's a big deal in the watch world. And to only come out with one.
He knows what he's doing. Yeah.
Yeah. So
he knows a thing or two, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. And this year it's an astronomic complication that, like, honestly, I have not done the research yet and cannot even tell you exactly how it works. But it's pretty crazy.
It's not rocket science, Stephen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. This guy with the jokes. Speaking of FP Journe, though, we have we had a pretty good encounter at that Bijorn this morning, didn't we?
Yeah. And I guess for you, you've obviously encountered him plenty before.
Yeah, yeah, a few times.
I have not.
We're not like hanging out getting drinks every weekend, course. But yeah.
I guess for me, it was so literally we sit down at the table and there he is. What's he doing? That's interesting. He's literally changing the strap on his own watch.
Yeah.
Just changing the strap.
Yeah. So it turns out this is kind of like inside baseball stuff, but you can't ship watches in and out of the United States on exotic straps.
Right, there's
all kinds of like wildlife regulations. So it's pretty common practice. Watch brands and auction houses ship things either on fake exotic straps or on calf because it's easy to kind of move around. So this was on a fake exotic orange strap, which is kind of his pairing with the blue dial. And because it's a synthetic, it had worn out,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to show it on a new strap. So
naturally.
Yeah. So naturally, when you need the strap on your FP Journe changed, you call FP Journe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, who better to change a strap than the man who created the watch?
Right? Yeah. So he was there with a smile on his face, changing the strap. He gave us a little nod, showed us the watch, and was on his way. But they're celebrating. He's in town because they're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the New York Journe Boutique this week. So shout out to our friends over at FP Journe. Congratulations. It's no small feat to have a successful boutique in New York.
Yeah, that was a cool experience for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. So you got to see the watches this morning. You get to spend some real hands-on time with them. I want to know, what are your favorites? Like, what are the watches that people should go check out? Because like we said, there's about 50 watches, some of them more interesting than others. What are the ones people have to go see?
I think the cool part about it is that there actually is something for everyone, all the way from, you know, high complications, all the way down to just, you know, an expression of a sports watch that is totally agreeable and attractive. And I guess I would say my top pick for the whole show was the Breguet Type 20.
Yeah, baby. That watch is so cool.
Yeah. I will go on record and say that I don't love Fotina. I don't know if that's a bad thing to say.
You're allowed, man. This is
if we're allowed to say that word, even.
Yeah, you can say that word.
All right, forget about the fact that it's a piece unique, this and that. Just looking at that watch, like visually, it is the best expression of Fotina or whatever.
We'll link it up so people can see it. But what can you describe the watch? What makes it special?
All right. Imagine pouring just enough milk into coffee to get it to turn that nice, creamy, rich brown.
So this isn't light and sweet. We're not talking like bodega coffee here.
This is the finest coffee of Switzerland and so forth.
Okay.
France.
Yeah.
And that's the dial color. And then on top of that, the lume is just, it works so well. It's not in your face. It's just, it looks like it may have been produced in period, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's essentially like a tropical dial.
It's like a tropical dial, but it doesn't like tropical dial. When we say tropical, it literally means that there's either been moisture damage or sun damage, right? This doesn't look damaged. It's so even.
Yeah.
It's like a perfect tropical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The seconds hand on that watch is so good. It has this sort of like really special, almost like leaf shaped seconds hand for the chronograph. It's not a detail I noticed at first. We were looking at the watches and photographing them, and I actually only noticed it through the camera at first, as I was trying to get like the right angle to not get reflection off the crystal.
Yeah.
And once I noticed it, it immediately was like my absolute favorite thing about the watch.
It's I think it'll be interesting to see what it looks like with the lights off.
Yeah.
It's thick with two C's.
Yeah.
Like it's a big, thick chrono hand.
Yeah.
It looks really nice. So definitely check it out. Yeah.
Yeah. I also like that they did the case back engraving. It almost looked like aftermarket engraving, which is cool. Like it's a sort of light, kind of like thin text. It looks almost like the engraving that like a soldier would have
put
on their watch.
Pilot.
Yeah, or a pilot would have had put on their watch. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. What's up next for you? So Breguet's up at the top. What are some other highlights?
Breguet's at the top. I guess we'll jump from sports watch. Before that, actually, I will say I totally dig the Blancpain as well.
Yeah, the Blancpain's nice.
That was cool. I mean, that's just another cool one. It's the only watch color is like this kind of like Tar Heels blue, Carolina blue, you know?
Yeah, it's like a really light
powder blue.
Yeah.
And So that's the theme of it. And they incorporated that color into the 50 Fathoms. And yeah, it just looks really nice. It works well. That color, black dial, crisp white loom. It's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah. Any other faves?
There were. I liked the Groenfeld.
Yeah, the Groenfeld.
I thought that was stunning.
Yeah, the Groenfeld's really nice.
Super, super cool. The Groenfeld 1941.
Mm-hmm.
That was really nice. Speaking of Tudor, you know.
Yeah, the Tudors are great.
Great? I don't know. Like,
oh, I was into it, man.
I was into it too, but we're pumping up this. Oh my God, the last one, the Black Bay one.
Yeah.
This is nothing like that.
No, this
is not the watch that people asked for.
No.
It's like, it's the watch that Tudor's giving us that is like, actually, that's kind of cool.
It's all matte black. Like
all matte
everything.
Black.
The hands, yep. The logo, the loom.
Oh, it's super great for legibility.
Yeah.
Super great.
Photographing it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I got to say, I mean, I don't think I'm going to surprise anybody here, but the Acrivia, dude. Oof.
Yeah, that's like...
Steel case produced by Hagman. This like beautiful blue grain dial, like... That would be it. I could have that watch and not need anything else.
It should say piece unique for SJP.
I mean,
it really should.
We could make that happen.
Yeah.
Should we crowdfund this? No, Gray's shaking his head. All right, the producer says no. All right, is crowdfunding canceled? Are we done? All right.
Another one that I like too. Again, I'm sure you're seeing a theme emerging here: sports watches. But I actually really like the Montblanc.
Yeah,
and
that's
Mont Blanc's
cool
kind of jumped on the scene. We did one, obviously.
Yeah,
and I just thought it visually looked cool. I mean, it's a good looking watch. It's like 40s, you know, those old 40s gilt dial chronos.
Yeah,
it's a modern take on that.
Yeah,
it's a playful, fun modern take, and it just looks good.
Yeah,
it's a
mono pusher split second. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, yep. And it's like this blue sort of like fumé dial. Yeah, I'm into it with like the snailed register. It's cool.
It's done well. And then obviously turning it over, that's where it gets really fun.
Those Minerva movements never
awesome.
Don't surprise me.
Yeah.
Like I every time I turn one of those over, I'm just like, oh my God.
Well, that's the thing. For me, I will, again, this is another hot take here, but I typically associate Mont Blanc with pens.
Yeah.
But when you turn that watch over and you look at that movement, whoa, okay, I get it. This is definitely a different level.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that for me, that was kind of the nice little discovery moment with that watch.
Yeah. I'm going to come in with a hot take. I legitimately am kind of into the Audemars Piguet, which is a Code 1159. It's a tourbillon open worked, but it's two-tone. It's kind of cool. It's got like a, you know, lugs and the bezel are white gold. The middle of the case is pink gold. The skeletonized movement is like a nice mix of the two. It's kind of cool. It's a lot, and it's not kind of what I would normally think of stylistically when I think of AP, but it's cool. And I think it works, and it's a little bit different. And like, you know, of all the code pieces I've seen so far, like this is the one that I got most excited about.
Honestly, right now, and Gray, you bear witness to this, I want to know how much did AP pay you to say that, Steven?
Not a penny.
Multiple pennies.
Many pennies, yeah. So many pennies. Yeah, any others before we wrap it up here?
One, and again, sports watch. No surprise there.
You with the sports watches, man.
I love the A386, that Zenith.
Yeah.
The El Primero. I thought that was so cool. That one, so you know, obviously the multicolored registers, one register is done in this only watch blue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually, it just works.
Yeah.
It works. It's really, really nice.
Yeah. It's a nice like little nod to only watch, but also to their history.
Right.
Which is cool.
And it, white gold is just dope.
So yeah.
Looks like stainless steel, which I like.
Yeah.
But a little secret, you know?
Yeah. Nice. Sweet. I think that'll do it. I mean, we're going to have a whole bunch of coverage of Only Watch leading up to the sale. During the sale, you'll be on the ground. We'll both be in Geneva the week kind of leading up to the sale. And then you'll be our man on the ground for this fall's auctions.
Yeah.
It's going to be an exciting week. So right.
In the trenches, in the thick of it.
Oh yeah. So we'll have Only Watch. We'll have the main Christie's sale.
Yep, rare watches.
We'll have two sales at Phillips. We'll have double signed and Geneva Watch Auction 10.
Yeah.
We have a Sotheby's sale to look at. I mean, things are heating up. So stay focused on Hodinkee for all your auction coverage. 2-3 weeks from now, you're gonna be so sick of hearing about it.
Yeah, probably be sick of me too.
Nah, that's fine. Never
call. I hope to cover it also from kind of a. Like sociology, what's it like? What are people like?
Oh, and man, you are in the watches for a treat.
The watches are cool, right? But
yeah.
I think what's even cooler is whatever this buzz that happens is. So hope to kind of, you know, look at it from that angle too.
You want a scene in the watch world? Geneva in November is as good as it gets.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome, man. Thanks for sitting down and chatting.
Yes, sir.
Next up, we've got James and my conversation with super collector and dealer Eric Koo. Good to have you back, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
We've got James here too.
Yep.
Nice.
Hello, James.
SF Crew. How's it going?
Yeah, SF Crew. Nice sunny day here in San Francisco.
Yeah, gorgeous day.
Yeah, man, oh man. I don't think either one of us wants to go back to the East Coast.
Nope, no thank you.
Yeah, I think you're going to have some new permanent residents
out
here.
All right, we welcome everybody.
So one of the reasons we wanted to have you back on the show, because you were one of our very first guests, is that on the show I asked you what restaurant you'd never been to that you were just dying to get to, and you said Ennaka. Oh man, I see.
Yes.
I see. Is that a menu?
I brought the menu with me.
Oh baby. So spoiler alert, you got in.
I got in.
When did that happen? How did that happen?
Our reservation was one of the last days that we were in LA, and it was like a nice send-off to our month spent down south. And the day before our reservation, I get a call from the restaurant at around 9 o'clock, and they said, "Hey, Mr. Koo, your table is ready. Where are you?"
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "No, you know, your reservation is today." We had just finished dinner driving home, and I had like a panic attack, and I was like, "You're wrong. You know, my reservation's tomorrow. I'm sure of it. Blah, 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 whatever." And the host, like, polite but firm, you know, like,
yeah.
"No, you know, for sure your reservation's tonight." And then I said, "Okay, let me go back to the house. I'll check. I'll forward you all these emails." And so I went home. I was right. The reservation was the next day. And then I forwarded to them. They called back and they're like, "Oh, this has never happened before, but we're switching reservation platforms." I don't know if you're familiar, but this Resy was purchased by American Express.
Yeah.
And they went to a new upstart called Talk,
okay,
which is founded by the Alinea people in Chicago.
Oh, cool.
And one of the executives there is actually a watch collector and a Instagram friend of mine.
Nice.
And they switched over to Talk, and they said that you know, they were having some problems with the old reservation system, but after like a brief panic attack, you know, my reservation was fine for the next day, and then, you know, everything was restored.
They made you sweat it out.
Yeah, though. Yeah, but I did sweat it out, you know.
Oof.
Yeah.
So then you went. And how was it?
It was really short answer is it was really great. The chef, Chef Nikki, who became quite famous to a lot of people after The Chef's Table on Netflix, you know, it was just really interesting. I've eaten at a lot of fine dining restaurants, but, you know, she really is like a rock star. I mean, you know, everybody at the restaurant, you know, was really excited to be dining there. People were really giddy to meet her when she came out. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. There was a table next to us, and one of the ladies at the table, I had overheard her basically, like, pouring her soul out to the chef, saying about how it's been the hardest year of her life. She quit her job. It sounded like she's opening, like, a restaurant or bakery or something. But then she was just telling the chef how, you know, she was like the inspiration for this, and, you know, she was waiting so long to be able to eat at the restaurant, and she was really pleased with everything, and it was really like inspirational to her, you know. I thought that was like a really magical thing that you don't really overhear these type of conversations at restaurants, you know.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
So should I go?
I mean, it was fantastic. Not pretentious at all. For fine dining standards, the pricing was quite reasonable. And, you know, a lot of times when you go to a nice, like a Michelin star restaurant, they bring out a wine list that's, you know, 300 pages. They have things that are up to thousands and thousands of dollars. They had a really simple, concise wine list. Most expensive thing was maybe several hundred dollars. It was nothing like in the thousands. And everything about the experience was really approachable. The staff was really nice. I liked how the chef, I think she's very much involved in the day-to-day of everything, because towards the end of the reservation, I mean, of the dinner, she had come out and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry about the reservation system. This has never happened. I can't believe it. Like, you know, we're really sorry."
That's wild.
For the chef to, you know, get into the minutia of running the front end as well as the back end of the restaurant, I think was pretty interesting.
That's super cool. I mean, one of the things I think that's interesting about this is, you know, as watch guys and car guys and basically cool stuff guys, the chase is such a big part of things, right? Like it's looking for that experience or that special thing that's not easily accessible. It's not a question of having enough money. It's a question of having the access and the time to look for it and the connections and the knowledge. So I think that's something that even, you know, people listening who aren't huge foodies or huge food enthusiasts can maybe relate to. But the next question is always like, once you get something, it's always the next hunt. So is there something that has now that you've eaten there, is there like a next place on your bucket list of restaurants you have to try?
I feel like Ed Naka was something that I had really been looking forward to for a long time. Very seldom do things meet or exceed your expectations. As you had mentioned, even especially with watches, a lot of times it's about the hunt and the chase. And then, you know, once you get a watch or, you know, achieve something, it's kind of like been there, done that. But again, I was really, really pleased with the meal there. It was fantastic. Everything about it was awesome. And I mean, in terms of culinary goals, if you will, I feel still very satisfied and still like kind of basking in that glow.
Nice.
Right now. So I'm quite content on that front.
Cool. Well, a lot more, I assume, has happened in your life in the last year other than going to Ennaka.
Sure.
Do you want to give us a little update on kind of what's changed in the world of Eriku since people heard from you last year? It's been about a year, I guess, almost exactly.
Okay, let's see. In the world of Eriku, there have been plenty of great watches. A slow and painful rebirth for my website.
Okay.
Which I don't know when this podcast will air, but it may or may not be up by then.
Okay.
What else is going on? A lot of travel, as usual. I recently got back from a leisure vacation, like a leisure trip to Italy for a couple weeks, which was really great. I don't take too many actual vacations, so this was quite nice. And I will say that there was a minimal watch business involved on the trip.
Never no watch business.
No. I was able to share a couple meals on the beach with our friend John Goldberger, which is always a fantastic thing.
Yeah, that's a treat.
Yeah. And, you know, other than that, just keeping busy with the grind of buying and selling watches.
Yeah. What do you you said there's been some great watches in the last year. Are there any pieces that have kind of come across your desk that are real standouts from the last couple months?
I mean, for me, it's not necessarily about like the value of the watch. It's something unusual. A couple things come to mind. I recently acquired one of the Rolex QA watches.
Oh, sweet.
It's a stainless steel one, so it's a smaller one. I think it might be 29 millimeters. Very small, but the watch is really nice because it's quite original, except for the luminous on the dial, which had been touched up at some point. But most importantly, it still has the Guillaume balance in the movement, which is irreplaceable and the most special part of it. I was speaking recently to Andrew Hildreth. Yeah. And he was explaining to me how I could actually find the records and the get the original QA certificate
from
the observatory in the UK. So I'm probably going to go ahead and try to research a little bit more about the watch.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Other things, you know, I think we had spoken about, and I showed you also this really weird transcontinental.
Yeah, that watch is so cool.
That I think maybe we'll talk about at some point in the future, but right now there's just not much information about it that that people know.
Have you seen this watch, James?
I have not.
Oh, I'll have to show you some photos after we're done recording. This watch is crazy. Can you describe it a little bit, Eric?
Looks like a mix between a turnograph and a Datejust. It's got a Datejust style dial in silver. But it has the words transcontinental on it.
Hmm.
It's got a very weird turning bezel that's graduated from 1 to 12, but with a really weird deco font that looks completely not Rolex. And it has a unique reference number. So something very strange that, you know, nobody really has been able to shed light on, except for the fact that, you know, there's maybe two or three other examples that have kind of surfaced over the last several years.
And the one you have has the papers and stuff.
Yeah, it has the timing certificate.
Yeah.
The guarantee paper is from Rolex Geneva. And it's just like an interesting thing, you know?
It's so strange. Yeah, you're going to love this watch, James. I feel like this could be a very you watch.
Sounds very cool.
Yeah. Other than that, you know, I was really excited last year at the Grand Prix. I was able to give out the award for the best men's watch, which Recep won. And I recently took delivery of my Chronometer Contemporain that he made, and it's fantastic.
So
it's on my wrist. I haven't taken it off since I got it, and it's really kind of like the Ennaka thing. It was worth the wait and very satisfying.
And yours is rose with the black dial.
Yes,
right?
Rose with the black dial.
Yeah, that watch, the first time I saw that watch, I had very little idea of what I was walking into. The folks who were handling some PR stuff for Acrivia reached out to us before Baselworld and kind of said, like, hey, would you come meet with us? We're like, yeah, sure. So as we were kind of figuring out who would attend what appointments, it fit into my schedule. So I went. And I knew that he was a good watchmaker. I knew he did interesting things, but it wasn't really my taste. It wasn't the sort of watchmaking I'm into.
Sure.
Kind of bigger, a little more aggressive styling, multiple tourbillons, like big crazy stuff. And I went to the meeting, and first of all, Recep is the sweetest person, such a nice down-to-earth guy, but he showed me this watch and I was like, what am I looking at? Like, I couldn't even wrap my head around it the first time I saw it. It is such a special piece.
Yeah, I mean, the like you said, personally, the aesthetics of his previous pieces were not necessarily something that, you know, had tremendous appeal to me. I definitely appreciated the craftsmanship in the watches, but the aesthetic really wasn't my thing. But you know, the first time I saw an early prototype of this watch, I won't say that I was sold on it, but I was intrigued. I listened to his idea about like why he was making this and what he was trying to accomplish. And you know, over the last few years, I'd seen many iterations of it. And you know, the final product just blew me away, you know?
Yeah.
Little changes I saw over time, the sub-seconds on the dial he ended up making, as a separate piece of enamel kind of recessed in, with a gold ring around it. And you know, little, tuning of like some of the, numbers and the fonts on the dial, the finishing on the movement, you know, it just really ended up being a fantastic piece.
Yeah. I know, James, you're not generally as big of a dress watch kind of guy, but what are your thoughts on this watch?
I mean, I haven't seen the rose before, so we'll take a peek after the recording, of course, but I mean, it's just gorgeous, for one, and there's a cohesion to the general like design of the dial and the hands that lends a balance that seems very considered.
Yeah.
And obviously with any, like Eric was saying, with and Steven yourself, like anything with the stuff that he makes, it's incredibly well made. It's beautifully finished. It's really top tier independent watchmaking. And to make something that's very much like more, certainly a dress watch, but like it has an everyday sort of appeal and a little bit more accessibility to the general level of the design, I think is fantastic. It's a gorgeous watch and has been in some of your roundup picks before.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I think
I think it's pretty safe to say. I think it was my favorite watch I saw in 2018. I feel pretty comfortable saying that.
You know, it's kind of funny. Like, I feel like in the world of independent watchmaking, people like to throw around this phrase of like, oh, so-and-so is like the next Philippe Dufour, you know, over and over again you hear this. And, you know, I think what Recep has accomplished with this watch really, you know, brings back a lot of thoughts of like the simplicity and you know, kind of like an updated, really beautiful, kind of timeless design, you know, that I think will age very well over the years.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's funny you bring up Philippe Dufour. I you know, in all my years of going to Baselworld, there have been two appointments where as I walked in, Philippe Dufour walked out, like we crossed in the doorway. It was that appointment, it was seeing Recep for the first time. And it was the first time I met Roman Gauthier. And as I was walking into the booths, or the booths, the little office areas, they're not huge, huge multi-brand booths, but yeah, Philippe was walking out. And I both times noticed and was like, huh, like if Philippe's here, this must be interesting. Like if this guy's paying attention, it's more than enough for me. I should definitely be paying attention.
My favorite Philippe Dufour / Houdinki moment was at the first summit. I was talking about vintage watches, fake vintage watches and whatnot. And we had a tray of fake Paul Newman dials.
Okay.
And then Will, I think, was the photographer that took the photo. But somebody, I think it was Will, took a really great photo of Philippe Dufour looping a bunch of fake Paul Newman dials. It's I'm sure it's in the archive on the website. It was just...
We'll have to go dig it up.
Yeah, that's a great photo. I blew it up and, you know, I have it like, on my
That's
phone.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
That's great.
He's an amazing guy, Philippe.
Oh, for sure. I mean, for somebody that has been elevated to such a godlike stature in our world, and, you know, there's this whole cult surrounding him, you know, couldn't be a nicer guy.
Yeah. And I love that he's so nice, but at the same time, because he's not kind of beholden to any of the groups or any of the brands, like, he's doing his own thing. He's totally independent. He'll give you the honest answer. Like if you ask him what he thinks about a watch,
for sure,
he'll tell you. He'll tell you either he loves it or it's shit, and he does not pull punches at all, which I love.
For sure, for sure. It was funny. A couple of years ago, I had my Simplicity serviced for the first time, and you know, I usually wear it on a Camille Fournay strap that I had made. Although you know, when Philippe delivers the watches, he has his own straps that are stamped Philippe Dufour. But I suspect that they're made by Camille Fournay. But anyways, it was very nice. He gave me the watch bag and said, oh, by the way, you should wear it on one of my straps. And he gave me like a new old stock Philippe Dufour, you know, strap for the watch that I thought was quite nice.
That's funny. As we're approaching auction season, the main auction season of the year, the November auctions, I've started to kind of chat with people and kind of feel out what people think is coming. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on kind of the general state of the vintage watch market and kind of maybe what we can expect in terms of trends or the kind of overall feel of the market in November. We're still a little ways away, but I think it's like time now to start thinking about it.
Yeah, I wish I had some juicy, salacious gossip about what's coming, but really I don't really have much of an idea right now. I mean, the things that have been announced, I think... you know, Philips is going to have another great evening sale in New York. They have the Jack Nicklaus watch and then the Marlon Brando thing, which is a fantastic story. I'm sure both of them will do quite well. And, you know, it's one of those things like you think about maybe we talked about this before, not necessarily on the podcast, but you know, what are the most important Rolexes out there? And, you know, this Marlon Brando one is certainly, like, one of those, you know.
Yeah.
GMT-wise, you know, we talk about, like, Che Guevara's GMT, Castro's watches. But this one being part of Hollywood is quite a historical timepiece, you know. With the recent passing of Peter Fonda, it brought me back to thinking about the Peter Fonda GMT that Heritage sold many years ago, you know. And in terms of, historical movie related ones. Really, I can't think of anything, you know, as important as maybe this Marlon Brando watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if there are, you know, we won't get the kind of exact bits of what kind of property is coming up for sale until we're a little closer, other than the highlights you just mentioned. But thinking about the market more broadly, I know summer, we're recording this the tail end of the summer, and it's kind of a slower time in the you know, collecting and dealing community. So, you know, it's maybe not the hottest point in the market. But have you noticed any general trends for the market that you think we'll see kind of being borne out over the auction season?
I mean, you know, scuttlebutt amongst, you know, my dealing colleagues, we always talk about, oh, summer, it's so slow. Like, you have anything going on? Like, what about you? So summertime generally, like you said, is quite a slow time of year. But I feel also that I think some of the vintage prices have really been climbing quite rapidly. And it's natural, it's part of a natural progression of things that, you know, the upward ascent may slow down, if you will.
Yeah.
I definitely feel a little bit of that. I think the market was a little overinflated over the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there might be some sort of a correction in line in terms of some of the pricing.
Yeah. I mean, something James and I see, you know, a lot dealing with vintage watches and new watches is that, you know, it's steel watches on bracelets are what everybody wants, right? It's Royal Oaks, it's Nautilus, it's Rolex sport models. Are you finding that demand to be the same in the kind of vintage world, or is it a little bit different?
I think demand for your bread and butter sport Rolex watches possibly has kind of gone down a little bit.
Okay.
You know, these are what everybody basically, when they get into watches, most people, I should say, this is the type of things that they collect. And I think many people have been buying these things over the last few years. And, you know, maybe there's like an evolution of like, hey, what do I collect next or whatever. But I don't really feel that strong demand for the sports stuff as, you know, the past few years have been showing, you know.
Any evidence that demand is shifting towards something else specific, or you think it's just kind of spreading out into the stuff that's surrounded already?
I think things got really expensive, like, very rapidly, and it's just kind of, I don't know, what the market will bear, I guess.
Yeah.
One particular thing that comes to mind is since the Paul Newman sale, you know, mainstream press has been talking about vintage watches and whatnot, and a lot of people, they just like Daytonas, you know. But putting things in perspective, like, I always cringe a little bit when somebody is describing a Paul Newman Daytona and they say exceptionally rare,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, these are very desirable watches, but exceptionally rare, like, they surely are not, you know.
Right.
Every auction season, there could be 10, 20 of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're very desirable, but I don't really think that rare is the right adjective used.
Yeah.
To...
I mean, if a customer called you and said, like, I want a Paul Newman, I'm willing to pay, like, fair market price, you could probably get them one pretty quickly, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of good, though. I think things got too expensive.
Mm.
I used to say a lot of times that I feel like a pump pusher Paul Newman is kind of the entry point for like a well-heeled collector that wanted to say like, hey, I want my first like nice vintage Rolex or something. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where that point of entry is over $200,000 now, which I think is quite absurd, you know?
That's, for most people, not a point of
completely
entry.
Completely inaccessible, you know?
So what's happened to the, not the bottom of the market, but the sort of, the new entry points, right? Like if a guy, one of the things we talk about is bringing new people into the hobby, right? Like how
sure.
Do you create the next generation or the next group of enthusiasts and collectors? And what that requires is people have to buy their first watch. They have to get excited about it. What are your thoughts on, you know, basic 5512s, basic 5513s, even basic date justs and day dates? As the prices climb up, what do you think that does to getting new people involved if getting into vintage Rolex now costs $10,000 or $15,000 as opposed to $3,000 to $5,000?
Any foray into these vintage watches now, as you'd mentioned, has become very expensive. And, you know, I used to think, like, you know, when people get married, I don't know if they still say this, but they used to say, hey, you spend 2 months' salary on, like, an engagement ring or something to that effect. There was some marketing spiel about it. I think that in my mind, I always thought, hey, you know, a nice place to get into vintage Rolexes is $5,000. Previously, at $5,000, you had quite a lot to choose from. You could buy a Matt Dial 5513, maybe a 1016, you know, a lot of things that kind of a sport category. But nowadays, we're seeing that entry level being, let's say, between $10,000 and $15,000, which, like you said, is it's a lot of money, you know. What does that mean? I see a lot more interest in, like, even more basic, if you will, vintage Rolexes. Two-tone date just plastic crystal used to be, you know, nobody wanted these things or nobody thought they were cool. But you know what? They're cool now because they're still at a fairly accessible price point, you know. But that being said, if you look at the new watch market as an indicator, I mean, your entry level to a sport Rolex is $10,000 to $15,000, you know?
Right.
And maybe not now because there seems to be a shortage everywhere. But, mm-hmm. you know, you could go into a Rolex store and anybody can go and buy like a new Submariner, or they used to be able to. and, you know, I thought that people that had a little more interest in diving a little beneath the surface would say, you know what, at that price point, I'd want to buy something unique like a vintage watch that they're not making any more of that will probably hold its value better, although that's not necessarily the case right now either with the new sport prices. But, you know, like it's just something different, you know. I always thought that vintage watches are something that there's a degree of expertise that you need to have to be into this hobby. And it shows a sort of a connoisseurship that doesn't necessarily exist when you just walk into a store and buy a brand new watch.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. It's something, I mean, we hear about it all the time is guys trying to get into vintage Rolex. Do you think, I mean, you mentioned two-tone date justs, but I mean, James and I field this question from people all the time and kind of shrug our shoulders, I think. I mean, James, do you agree?
Like where to start?
Yeah, where to start.
With actual vintage?
Yeah.
Or just a model that's not made anymore?
Actual vintage.
I don't know what it would be for Rolex anymore. I mean, I've been telling people like 14270s, 114270s, you know, the 36 millimeter Explorers are rad, but I don't think they count as being like.
I mean, fundamentally, I get, you know, asked this probably just as much as you guys do,
right.
And I can say that
or more, yeah.
I really don't like this question.
Okay.
the reason Perfect. Why I don't, and it, you know, it's not anything whatever, but I know when I first started, like the first watch that I loved was like a 1016 Explorer, okay? And I loved it because of the way it looked, the story, the history. And, you know, I just find it a little odd when people are like, hey, you know, what should I get into first? Because, again, obviously, with the prices the way they are now, it's hard to ignore the financial realities of the money aspect of things. But, again, I think you should be buying something that you like. Like, you know, we shouldn't have to tell you, hey, like, you should like a two-tone GMT or a two-tone Datejust, you know? So I just think that...
And also, like, where you started, you were saying, like, when you got in on the 1016, did someone have to tell you it was the 1016, or you spent time to develop that as a form of taste?
I just liked the watch. I mean, honestly, it was just what I liked.
So maybe the answer is get on the internet and find the watch that you really want. And then see if it's something.
But then again, when I started, I think the 1016s, they were like $3,000.
Oh, man, that hurts my soul.
Yeah.
No, I love that idea. I mean, I love the idea that like asking what should I buy to get into it is the wrong question. What you should be doing is finding what you like and then finding a way to get into it.
Because, I mean, one thing that has been proven over time is I feel like, generally speaking, Rolex has been a decent store of value.
Yeah,
I don't want to say like appreciating, but, you know, it stores its value well. Mm-hmm. And so you can't really go wrong with any Rolex, in my opinion. And I think that being the case, you know, you should look at what you like, you know, what you like slash what is in your price range that you're comfortable with, you know.
That's what we always say on the Grenada when somebody writes in with what should I buy? It's just buy something that's in your price point that you like, that makes you happy.
I mean, that's pretty good criteria for buying anything, let alone not just watches. I know the bulk of what you do is Rolex related.
Sure.
But giving some people some places to look to maybe find the thing that they like outside of Rolex as the Rolex prices creep up. Are there other places that you think, you know, without telling people like, oh, you should go buy this, are there other places that you think people should look into in the history of watches that might give them some other options and some things to get excited about that might be more affordable?
I mean, personally speaking, other like big brands that I like, which I would mention, obviously, like Patek, AP, things like this. But everything is quite expensive right now. But... you know, I think we maybe talked slightly about this in our previous podcast, but, you know, if you buy on, like, design, right, there's plenty of no-name slash lesser famous name watches that are, like, vintage that are, like, really cool, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of the many business ideas that I had over time that I didn't have time to bring to market is I would love to have a website that just sells vintage watches that are under $1,000, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what brand they are, but just something that like looks good and is kind of cool, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite vintage Pateks is a 565, which is a screw back case like Calatrava.
Yeah.
It just has a really nice look. And the funny thing is the case manufacturer for that actually made basically the identical case for many other brands. Doxa comes to mind, Movado, you know, and all sorts of other brands like that. And, you know, it's very funny. One of my favorite singular vintage watches is the black Radium 565. Patek Philippe, they call it the Night Watchman, which recently sold at Philips a few years ago. I found a little Doxa with a black radium dial that is maybe 29mm, but looks identical, you know, and same style case, same dial, style dial and everything. So, you know, really, I think if you are buying things for its aesthetic merits, you know, there's a whole lot of things that you can be kind of getting into that don't necessarily involve, you know, one of the big brands.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think the kind of key there is having the knowledge and kind of knowing where to look for those sorts of things. Are there resources, not just for purchasing, but for kind of learning and getting knowledge, you know, whether it's books or things people can find online that you think as somebody who's in this all day, every day, you think are good places to kind of go learn, where even if you're not purchasing, it's a good place to kind of get that info so you can then make those kind of informed decisions?
I mean, the scholarship on, you know, kind of the smaller Swiss brands is quite limited, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, when I first started being involved with watches, there was definitely, there was no Houdinki around. There wasn't as much information on the internet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the best places to just look at pictures of things was eBay. And I still think that's true because it's one of the biggest international marketplaces. And, you know, just off the top of my head, I've seen really fantastic kind of, you know, old chronographs from, you know, with really weird names that are quite funny, like the Record Watch Company. I've seen chronographs with the name Harvard on it, you know, just like weird stuff that probably nobody knows anything about some of these brands, but design wise, they're, you know, they're quite nice things, you know.
Cool.
And on a lot of them, I'd say, like, especially with old chronographs, it's like the case maker is the same as possibly some Patek Philippe's. The movement is a Valjoux movement that's very similar to like a Rolex movement. And, you know, basically it's just the name that makes a difference by a magnitude of maybe 20 at the end of the price, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is something that I think people don't necessarily know enough about or appreciate enough about the watch industry is that, today it's all about in-house movements. It's all about as much manufacturing under one roof as possible. But the industry was never traditionally like that. There were, I mean, there still are suppliers who everybody's buying from, but it's a little, I would say, less diffuse than it used to be. But it really used to be, you know, there was a case maker and they made cases for 20 brands at every price point, right?
Yep. I mean, now it's all about, like you said, vertical integration, everything in-house. But, you know, in the old days, there were case makers that made cases for, you know, a multitude of brands, you know. I believe, like, Rolex always made their own stuff. Mm-hmm. But even Patek Philippe, the case makers were other, you know, other brands. You look at, like, the early perpetual calendar chronographs, 1518s, 2499s, you know, there were a multitude of brands that were making the cases for them. And I should step back and say, before Rolex got vertically integrated, they were relying on a couple case makers too. One was called Gen X. Spillman was another one that made most of the chronograph cases for Rolex. So, you know, it was really, it wasn't important in those days to have everything made in-house. Now I feel like because the price points have gotten very high, they use this as like a marketing thing to justify why the costs are so high.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think that it makes it a better product.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my next question, is kind of where do you guys stand on kind of the value of in-house, and whether that's actually something that delivers value to the customer, or whether it's a kind of like box you can check as you try to like justify it to yourself.
I mean, this is a really blasphemous thing, but I kind of feel like it's way overrated.
Yeah, no, that's not blasphemous at all.
I feel better about my answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, there's scenarios like, obviously Eric and I exist in very different aspects of the watch market, where like you have experience with some truly fantastic watches on a day-to-day basis, and I'm dealing with modern product typically, and sure. I love stuff under $5,000. That like that's what I would like to write about for Hodinkee. And even if you look at something like for me, the only time where I feel like the in-house really gets me something is when it's either incredibly beautiful, like a Jorn, where I know that I can appreciate that for all the work that went into it, but that's not your under $5,000 or even under $10,000 equation. At the let's call it entry luxury price point, there are some ergonomic and like kind of tactile feedback things that aren't so pleasant about a basic ETA 7750. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you move one step off of that, whether it's into the column wheel chronograph that's through the ETA channel, it's an L388 or 811 or whatever from that's in like the Longines Big Eye. It's just a much more pleasant thing to actually press the buttons on, and you can't feel the rotor spinning every time you go to pick up your coffee. And so there's little things like that reflect on me. But when it comes to like the difference between if you look at my, I have a Polar Explorer 2, you know, the last generation. And if you pick that up next to my Doxa, I don't think you could shake them around and feel any external difference to the movements. The Rolex one is a better movement and genuinely keeps better time than the ETA in the Doxa. I don't feel that different about the two of them. At a certain price point, I think like it all comes out in the wash. Is it accurate? Can you get it serviced 5 years later, et cetera?
I agree.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I asked the question, but I'll also answer it. But
there is a fantastic price point, like what's on your wrist, and you know, something like a Jorn, where you're paying for something so gorgeous.
But I mean,
so
something at that price point, I like to think of it like, what are you spending your money on when you're buying like a really nice independent watch like that? You're kind of being a patron of the individual.
Yeah, absolutely.
But B, it's like you're paying for, you're buying artwork, basically. You know, it's something that is from the hand of the master, if you will, and it's something like very tactile and special. But at I don't know if this is the right term, like at commercial price points, whether it's like 5 to 10,000 or whatever, the in-houseness, because it's made by, you know, robots and whatnot anyways, like it kind of loses its appeal to me. You know, it doesn't mean as much in my opinion.
And I mean, unless the watch could offer, say, a much thinner profile than its contemporaries, where like, you know, ETA with the higher end, the 2892, it's quite a bit thinner than a 2824. That's better. Could mean your dive watch is somewhat thinner or whatever. Or if you run into a feature set that's different, like the difference between a, your normal independent 24-hour hand GMT, which you can get from ETA or Salida, but you can't get a local jumping like you, like Tudor or Rolex will make. That makes a big difference for me. I'll pay the money for the local jumping. That's a much more functional sort of outlay. That's why I have the Explorer 2, is because it has that ability to jump the hour hand. And then you see that in other brands in-house. You know, Omega has a jumping hour even on non-GMTs, as does Panerai. So when you go to change the time, you can change the hour separately without losing the accuracy of the seconds hand, which even if it's not a GMT, that's good functionality. So if that's what might separate them from a modified ETA or a base ETA, I get it.
Yeah.
But it has to be.
I feel like with this war of racing to make everything in-house, it's like everybody keeps trying to reinvent the wheel over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's tried and true things that just work, you know?
Yeah.
Cool innovations in in-house manufacturing, I think, would be something like the RD2 movement in AP,
right,
making a ridiculously thin, you know, perpetual calendar automatic movement, you know, and pushing boundaries that were not possible in the past. Like, this is cool stuff. This is kind of like, you know, like a space race of its own.
Yeah.
But, you know, just saying, hey, this is an in-house time-only caliber, but it doesn't really do anything new, but it's in-house, like, that's not that interesting to me, you know?
So to wrap things up, we're starting to run a little low on time, but something we've been doing on the show that we didn't get to do with you the first time around is the Hodinkee questionnaire.
Okay.
So I've got a couple rapid-fire questions I just want to ask you here at the end.
All right.
So first up, what's a watch you've seen recently that really caught your eye?
I think the one on my wrist, the Chronometer Contemporain, it's fantastic.
Perfect. What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
We had a really great time in Italy. We went to the beach a lot, and, you know, it's not an experience that I've been used to, but it was really fantastic, and I quite enjoyed it.
Great. What's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure is eating a fourth meal at midnight if I'm still awake.
Perfect.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm in on that. And the last one is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
The best piece of advice that I had ever been given was, this is a tough one. I think the best piece of advice that I was ever given was by my parents, and just said, whatever you're going to do, just be the best at it.
So to actually wrap things up, we always like to finish with a cultural recommendation. So what's a book, a movie, TV show, something you recommend people go check out after they're done listening to this episode? It could be a place you visited, a meal you've had, just something people can go experience for themselves.
I watched a very good documentary on Netflix recently. I think it was the first one that was one of those ones produced by the Obamas.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I haven't gotten to watch it.
Like, I'm trying to remember the name, but it was basically about a Chinese company who opened a factory in the States. And kind of like, I don't know if you guys remember, in the, not really, but if you remember in the 80s, they had this movie called Gung Ho about this Japanese car company that came to the States and, you know, opened up this factory to save the town.
Okay.
It had a little bit of that feeling, but
American Factory?
Yes, American Factory is what it's called. And it was just like really fantastic. It told like a, I thought like quite a balanced story from the side of the Chinese management, and then also showing like the day-to-day struggles of, you know, these lower wage earners in the United States. It's a
great,
really great movie.
Awesome. I'll have to go check that out. James, you have something for us?
Yeah, mine's an easy one. It's a movie from 1948. I actually think oddly enough, the last time we did this, I recommended a Hitchcock movie because we were in San Francisco.
Yes.
I recommended
Vertigo.
Vertigo. Thank
yeah.
you. So I'm going to follow it up with another Hitchcock. Oddly enough, I just watched it. I'm loosely obsessed with it. I've watched it a couple times now. Is Rope.
Oh man.
And I'll keep it quick because we are short on time. But it is just the most fantastic presentation, tone, and pacing in a film I've come across in a long time. I mean, he is, without a doubt, the finest filmmaker in history, and this is one of his finest pieces of work. It's so patient, it's so weird, and it's so special all at the same time.
I will say really quickly, I have a very hard time watching old movies now just because the production value is not like new ones. Yeah. But the Hitchcock movies are the exception.
They hold up so well.
They're always fantastic. They're amazing. They've aged very, very well.
So Rope feels like a play. It's shot as though it's one shot, so they'll occasionally zoom in on someone's body while people are repositioning. Mm-hmm. It's
also because they technically couldn't do it in one take. Like the cameras didn't hold enough film. Yeah.
But it's just... it's simply a fantastic film. So Vertigo, I still stand by. Of course, North by Northwest, these are all wonderful. But Rope is a whole different thing. It's so good.
I'm going to cheat here really hard and just double down and say, please go watch Rope. I think I first saw this movie maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little more than that. And I watch it at least once a year.
Don't nobody remake Rope.
Yeah, please don't make... if you remake Rope, we're done. I'm done with you, whoever you are, if you remake Rope. But just go watch Rope. It's Jimmy Stewart being super weird the whole time. Oh, yeah. It's awesome.
So
it's
I have a more important question about Rope.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it free streaming on Netflix, or do I have to pay $3.99 to rent it on Amazon Prime?
I think you have to pay to rent it.
I found it on Amazon Prime. It's on Amazon? It's free on Amazon
Prime. Okay. All right. That's good to know.
So... next time we have you on, we're going to check in. Okay. Make sure you've seen Rope.
I'll make sure to watch it.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks and it's good, always good to see you when we're out here.
Thanks for having me.
This week's episode was recorded at the podcast studio in San Francisco, California, and at Hodinkee HQ in New York City. It was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.